accession number 20610, reel 3.
Jeff Welch, reel 3.
Pete Kemble, our driver, decided I most probably bought it. He decided he was going to get out of it and see if he could get free. Anyway, he got across the open ground okay, met up with our people again, the officer, Captain Callender, and all the infantry people. And anyway, they mounted on an attack that breaks down. There is always a counter-attack. People in reserve. Anyway, they mounted a counter-attack later in the morning. But by this time, Jerry had gone off. He'd decided he'd taken his rent for the ground, like, and you could have it now. But by this time, they come back. Peter Campbell had come back with the counter-attacking people, and he knew where I was, and he knew where the officer was. And so he came to me, and the medics picked me up, and they said I was alive. Went to the officer, like, and he was dead. But of course, you know, he generally came round to view the ground, kind of thing. Anyway, they decided there was so much, we'd fired so much ammunition. I'd been already out scavenging in the wood in between lull periods, trying to get ammunition and different weapons to keep it going, kind of thing, while Pete done the firing. Anyway, I came to your mind wanders. In a half track, I knew I was in a half track, you knew by the sound of it. Your head facing towards the back door, and the in your mind of instantly, who am I with? My own people, or am I a prisoner of war? the door opened in the half track. There's a forward area where, like, from the main base up to the driver, you open like a little iron door. They opened this iron door, somebody did, that part of the half-track crew, and I could see the driver sitting up there with his British tin hat on, brown uniform with the sleeveless leather jacket. I knew I was all right with my own people then. And they dropped me back at a field hospital. Eventually I went to a hospital at Bayou. They shipped me back on a Dakota to Blackbush Airfield at Blackbush, just down the Great West Road. Anyway, I finished up in Park Pruitt Hospital in Basingstoke. Pete Kemble, he went back for a while. Now, right, that's as far as I go at this stage. Now, right, I got hospitalised. Anyway, went for rehabilitation, convalescent, all like that. Later in the year, I decided that I'd like to write to several of the boys. Thought I'd write a letter to Pete Kemble and some of the other people, find out what was happening. To my amazement, he wrote back, "Well, shit, they've been trying to track you in UK." I said, he said, "You and me have got on his letter that him and I have got a military medal, and Captain Callan got an MC for that morning." And anyway, I couldn't believe it, so I went along to the CO's office, showed him the letter. So he said, that sounds good news. He said, but I'll have to check. Anyway, I don't know, I say 2 or 3 days later, a week, he got called to the office. He said, "It is true, you have." And he had a bit of ribbon at the side. He said, "You better sew that up." And he said, "You can have a weekend pass." So I had a weekend pass. And anyway, gradually went back. You finish up, you got past A1 again. After your face was all burnt black in the fire, that was burnt black. I remember at Park Pruitt, there was a little nurse every day going to come and take the black stuff off and put saline. And they stitched up the arm and took a bit of shrapnel out the back. They had it on a bit of cotton wool at the side of the bed. It all got lost over the years. It was about as big as a farthing in those days, and a bit thicker. And anyway, it finally got back past A1. And then rejoin your unit. And some of the men were very unhappy because they weren't going to rejoin their own unit. But I was lucky. Yes, you're going back to the Greys. And I arrived back. We went back through Dover, Ostend. Now, Ostend in those days was a town, all cobbled streets. What marching through to the station. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I rejoined the regiment at a place called Wesel. It was in Holland, Northern Holland. Wesel. Went back, and of course, by this time I'm wearing glasses. The old army rim spectacles kind of, iron frame kind of things.
Why are you wearing glasses?
Well, because I got burnt and it upset my eyes. I'd had a bit of trouble with my eyes afterwards, didn't I, in the hospital, wouldn't I? When I was on leave once, I had to go to hospital because they, I suppose it was flash thing, heat had done it. So I had like the face burnt black and all the thing, and the heat must have upset the eyes, which they've done to this day. The bullet wound in the arm and a piece of shrapnel in the back. And of course your tank suit that morning was just charred off you. Whereas, you know, although it was flame proof, it wasn't fireproof. And anyway, I got to Park Pruitt, they sent me back and I rejoined the regiment at Wesel, Northern Holland, early in January. Now, right.
What state were they in?
Well, they were back reforming. They'd had, slogged all the way up to that place, all through France and everything. Lots of new faces. But Pete Kemble, the driver, was still driving. He hadn't knocked out or injured or anything. He's still driving all the way across France, all out. And of course, we got together and we worked out. He told me what had happened after I'd left and everything like that. So it put me in the picture.
Had you gone back to B Squadron?
B Squadron again, yes. But when I got back with glasses, no way you're going to do gunnery. Crew wouldn't have me with glasses, would they? What's your driving like? Oh, yes, I passed out. So, right, although I did driving, I had to start doing it again because you've been out of practice, hadn't you? And you drive, comes second, like riding a bike, isn't it? It comes back to you. Anyway, I decided I was all right. And so I went to co-driver at first, like hull gunner, that is. Then, I don't know, a couple of weeks later, I got, when they started changing around, I got transferred up to proper driver. And from that day, I drove right till the end of the war, Sherman's.
Can you take me through the experiences that you had in the last months of the war, please?
Yes, yeah. Eventually, we crossed the Rhine. Now, we crossed the Rhine, I don't know when, it was early days, you know, but we crossed the Rhine on a pontoon bridge. It was a bridge built of pontoons all the way across the Rhine. I mean, when I say a bridge, there was lots and lots of these bridges, but I mean, we crossed on a pontoon bridge to the other side. Now, we weren't the first by any means. Plenty of people had got the other side and it all spread out. We were just like coming along for backup. And of course, you know, Germany is a huge place. You spread out, and I mean, you want plenty. I mean, I only talk about my specific tiny, tiny area. We don't know what's going on in other areas. You just know what you get told. We're pushing on to so-and-so. Sometimes you make it, sometimes you don't. And you sometimes meet resistance, heavy resistance. You lose people and equipment. Other days you can go two or three days and not encounter anybody. It's, aggressive kind of thing. So, I mean, of course, as you fan out, different regiments, divisions are all taking up the ground. You get the general picture, but you don't know, because the officers keep you informed because they have O group meetings, don't they, with the commanding officer. He keeps them in the picture of what he knows. But the grand plan, you don't know. You only learn these things later. It's like these beaches on D-Day. We didn't know it was Salt Gold, Juno, and all. Just a bit of beach as far as we were concerned. Anyway, we pushed on, all kinds of traumas and all like that, and you know, you do lead in tank for a couple of days, and so you might meet nothing, and then you meet heavy resistance. Your people were coming and going from casualties, and but you kept going. And I was then at Bremen. We've got to Bremen. On the outskirts of Bremen, we stopped. Everything stopped on the outskirts of Bremen, and when a couple of miles away in the distance, we could see like the town of Bremen with the churches and all like that. We stopped, and I suppose we're bringing up all the main divisions kind of thing, whatever it is, before they mounted the assault on Bremen. And heavy bombing raids over there and all like that. So we had a few days, lovely rest. I mean, whenever you rested over a certain period of time, one, your first love was your tank. That had to be always up to par before you did anything yourself. That had to be, you know, kept operational at all times. And then the day came, right, this, we're moving off in the morning kind of thing, first light, the artillery all opens up, and you go to move off. But we were stopped. They sent in a squadron of Churchill's flamethrowers. Anyway, they ran over some of these mines or bombs that had been dug in the roads. And of course, that result, poor old Churchill gets like an old tin can that's been buried 6 months, isn't it? So we came on and we got involved in the fighting around Bremen, and it's a huge town. And then we got knocked out again in the street fighting at Bremen. But this time, we got a bazooka or Panzerfaust in the engine from behind us. Now, when the old Panzerfaust hit, you get this terrible bang, and the thing fills up with smoke. Fills up with smoke, like you've got to bail out, haven't you? Now, that's the moment of truth in street fighting, opening the hatches and bailing out. Because if they've been near enough to a Panzerfaust, they're near, aren't they? Anyway, the sergeant who was with us, he said, the house to the left, blah, 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 every, you know, 11 o'clock, door open. Anyway, cut a long story short, we all got out, made this doorway, all fell over in a pile on each other's self as made the doorway. No one was hit, nothing was fired at us. The only thing is, we'd arrived there, didn't have a weapon between us. No one had a pistol or anything. So we had to stay in this big house kind of thing until the infantry came up. And then we went back, like through the back areas, and we had to go back to a brigade to get a new Sherman, which, I mean, took 72 hours because they were coming up all the time on Sherman. Anyway, we rejoined the regiment more or less at the dog's leg of end of Bremen, like it had all been finished by then. Then they swanned out, the big swan out, up towards, right into Germany. There again, you meet opposition, you don't meet opposition. Up to our left was Lübeck, where there was hell of a do going on, but we weren't involved, we went round. But they said that we did a lot of miles in one day. I reckon we did about 40 miles, when everything was collapsing, Germans were collapsing, giving up. We came to this railway, and we stopped a hospital train coming back from the Russian front. A full-blown hospital train with doctors, wounded. They were all looking out the window at us, couldn't believe it, what was happening. And we put that into a station, or they did, they put it into a station and connected it all up with water and left it there. But then we carried on. The object was to do mileage, to get as much ground as we were coming, because we knew the Ruskies were coming the other way. Didn't know, well, I suppose someone knew where they were, but we didn't. And I remember that particular day when the Germans were coming down, just like a football crowd turning out, down this main road kind of thing in the country, all thousands and thousands of them. We were moving up, and we did so many miles that day, it was untrue. I mean, we had to stop every now and then because the tracks were getting slack. The rubber on the bogey wheels and jockey rollers were being chewed off, but we made it. And we arrived at a place called Wismar. Wismar, that's up on the Baltic. That day we were carrying airborne troops on our back, on our engine decks, six to every tank. The object was, any opposition they could often sort it, but there wasn't any opposition. It was all, everybody was throwing their hand in, like from the German side. But we had to make ground. Anyway, we met in this airfield at a place called Wismar on the Baltic. And whether this day, we don't know whether the Russians fired at us or we fired at the Russians, but we met on this airfield, and I can remember some aircraft taking off, German aircraft taking off. They must have been flying to Switzerland, I suppose, taking, you know, planes. We met up with the Russians, and of course, big handshakes and looking over each other's tanks and drinking and hugging and generally making a fuss of each other. And then that night, they pulled to one side of the airfield and we pulled to the other side. So the airfield in those days was in between us. So in those days there was a no-go area. And then we celebrated, in the, you know, because you always manage to acquire things to help you celebrate. I know we set fire to a haystack. That was our bonfire.
You said that you and the Russians opened fire on each other?
Well, we must have done. I think we did, because we were so close and we didn't know who. We had fire coming back at us. Now, we were so close. Now, the Russians most probably thought they were being fired at by the Jerry. I mean, as you become close like that, you don't know whether Jerry's firing at you. I mean, all right, you're over-firing each other, aren't you? But you don't do it. You just think it's the opposition until the forward units make contact with each other. I mean, once the reconnaissance from our people and their forward units meet, it's all done, isn't it?
What did the Russians look like?
Oh, very basic. Very, very basic. They lived off the... I understand they lived mostly off the land. We had a look in each other's tanks. And these T-34s, which was the Russian... Look in there and you can see vegetables laying around. Oh, they were, you know, very, very nondescript. I mean, most probably terribly hard. Well, they were, because their standards were much harder than us. Whereas we had our compo rations in the box at the back of the turret, you know, ready to eat at all times. I understand that they lived a lot of the time off the land, ate as they went along, you know. So, you know, but they're... Their T-34s were very basic. That's their tanks were very basic. And you'd be surprised the amount of women that were there. Later on in the afternoon, the forward units we met were light armoured cars and their T-34s, their Russian tanks. But later on in the afternoon, we see some of these women. And I mean, they didn't have slacks on. They had skirts of these high boots, you know, the... knee-high boots.
In what way were the T-34s so basic?
Well, they didn't have wirelesses like we had for intercommunication. I understand, I don't know whether it's true or not, but you ask, where's your what? Because we couldn't speak Russian, they couldn't speak English. And you show them out, you say, well, where's your one? Haven't got one. And their basic layouts were much more basic than ours in the hulls and inside the turrets and in the front. I mean, I suppose they mass-produced them quickly and they just had their basic. But the way I feel about it, that the commander had to kick the driver either left or right shoulder to tell him which way to turn, because there was no... When you talked over your intercom and showed them, you know, they went, no, you know, you couldn't speak the language, but you understood what each other was saying, kind of thing. Oh, no, they were much basic, but they did the job, didn't they? That was the thing. I mean, it's like the Shermans. The Shermans were no match for the German armour, but the overpowering mass, you know, overwhelmed them. I mean, it's like these Russian T-34s. Turn out hundreds, thousands of them. You lose some, but most of them get through, don't they?
What was the behaviour of the Russians towards you like?
Oh, it was all hospitality, because we'd met up. I mean, later on, I don't know. But on that particular day, it was all nicely. Everyone was happy. It was going to be over. We'd all met up. Everyone was happy, laughing, joking, drinking, showing each other what the different things were and each other in our own way, because we couldn't understand each other. But... you managed to make yourself understood.
What was the relationship like between Germans and Russians in Wismar?
Oh, no. When the war, the Germans did not want to go to the Russians. When you speak to them and you were, if they were start getting stroppy, you only threatened to send them back to Ivan, as they called them, and they fell in line. They wanted to be a prisoner of war with the Allies, not with Ivan. Definitely, that's why they were all coming west, weren't they? There was nobody going east. They knew they'd have a fairer crack of the whip with the Allies than going east to the Russians, or Ivan as they called him. No, you could get anything done. Just threatened to send them back to Ivan.
What happened next?
Well, then it was a huge clear up. Right. Now, right, the tanks were finished. They were parked up. We had like some barracks and rooms and all like that. The tanks were finished. And then, right, the great demob started. Demobilisation. Everybody had groups. I was group 52. Now, about the first 10 demob groups more or less went immediately. Now, that left us very short of people. Now, right, the tanks were parked up and every regiment had to supply transport with drivers. And, I mean, things had to be moved. You either had to... There was a lot of German ordnance laying around which had to be brought to central areas and demolished. All the tanks and all that were finished. Everybody wanted transport and drivers to move things here, there, up, down. So every regiment was allocated a daily dose of transport to go to a central depot to do what they were told, transporting things. Now, right, the tanks, eventually, we got rid of so many tanks. They were taken to the station with flat trucks, and I mean, if you had, say, 19 in the squadron, you finished up with 10. Because don't forget, you didn't have the crews. A lot of the crews were going home and on leave and all like that. So, right, what they did then, they picked out the best ones and kept them. Those that were time expired or troublesome, they let go back and they were transported away. Now, right, the shortage of crews, you might have, say, 3 tanks to look after. Every day you had to start them up. And there was kit inspection on them. We had to bull them all up. I mean, that's because they were in this hard ground, and they had to be bulled to make them look right for the German people and all like that. I suppose that was the thing. You had all time. Then you got guard duties and everything like that. So it was very, very, very. What would be the word? You were very, very busy doing everything. You know, the guard duties you had, I mean, we had, they started saying about your webbing equipment, guard duties, you had to have that cleaned up and make yourself look. Now, we've worn webbing equipment for months. It was oil stain and God knows what else. Anyway, right, Romanian prisoners of war, there was a party of them up there. They were doing jobs kind of thing, you know, like gutty jobs. We gave them, cleaning and all like that. Nothing like a warlike, but cleaning jobs and, you know, digging jobs and all like that. And we gave them this webbing with a 5-gallon drum of petrol. Anyway, they cleaned it for us, got it all up lovely, white and polished. That cost us some cigarettes. I don't know whether that's viable on there, is it? To see, won't we? Anyway, we got back to normal again, but it was a very traumatic period because there was so much going on. And then we moved back. You kept moving back. This was a part that always perplexes me. We got to Wismar, right up on the Baltic. And then eventually, we came back to Lübeck. Now, the soldiers slogged all the way on all the fronts up to the Baltic, down. Then the politicians sat round the table and they decided that we would have to move right back to Lübeck. The Russians would take over that ground. Now, you know, you think of the people and equipment you'd lost getting up there, and the politicians just leave it out, make you move back to how it was. Anyway, then one of our, I don't know whether this would be any interest to you, one of our trips, we didn't know it at the time, was to Belsen. You know, there was so many lorries, whatever daytime, sometimes you'd go with on your own, other times there'd be 3 lorries, other times there'd be a little convoy of a dozen lorries. All had to go to this main depot, sometimes to the railway sidings, load up, and you were told with the officer where to go, everything like that, or you'd have to move stuff. This particular day, got a small convoy, about a dozen vehicles. And on my particular one was a 3-ton Bedford I was driving, full of palliasses and mattresses. And we got loaded. Anyway, the officer took us off, map reference, blah, blah, blah. We're just driving our convoy, don't we? And we got to this place. It was all barbed wire, and the British soldiers were there. And these people in this funny, stripy uniform. Anyway, we didn't know what it was, because Belsen didn't mean anything to us. It was so early on. It hadn't been, like, released officially, and all the horrors that were going on and all like that. Anyway, we backed into this place eventually, like, you know, when your turn came, you back in. These blokes, didn't see any, can't remember seeing any women. These blokes, all this, and looking very thin, all like that. But all a hell of a lot of British medical people there. They came aboard and they unloaded it, took it all away and all like this bedding. As far as I was concerned, that was it. You drive back and you rejoin the convoy ready to come out again. But we all agreed, all us blokes, what a terrible, terrible smell. You could not believe the smell. And everybody was saying about the terrible, terrible smell that this place. And of course, sometime later you read or hear about the Belsen camp, don't you? But you can say you've been, but you didn't realise what it was at that particular time. And I mean, I say 2 or 3 hours, might not have been as long as that. You were there unloading and, you know, getting ready to turn around and come out again. This terrible smell, you remember it even to this day. And of course, later on, you hear all the things about these various places, don't you? But at that time, we didn't know, but the smell stuck with us.
So when were you demobbed?
June 1947.
Were you in Germany?
In Germany. In right, then later on, we moved back to Lüneburg, where we were based right till the end of my time. Lüneburg is just outside, 30, 40 kilometres from Hamburg.
So you were occupying troops in Lüneburg?
Lüneburg. We took our tanks, what was left of them, back. And of course, Lüneburg was one of the main German armoured, because it was like our Salisbury Plain. And so we moved back, beautiful barracks there, they were all beautiful. I mean, but not just our regiment, I mean, there was lots and lots of other regiments all round about. But Lüneburg was the main, like, for the armour kind of thing, of all different types. And we used to go on evening or weekend to Hamburg, where the, as I told you before, the Victory Club, they called it. It was a huge hostel. I can't remember how many floors, but it was run by the NAFI. And then, of course, you could go swanning around Hamburg, you know, looking at it, but always in a party. Because those days, early days, there was a non-frat ban on. You couldn't fraternise with the locals. Later on, it was all eased, but at the early days, you couldn't fraternise with the Germans. So you went out, like, party-handed, 4 or 5 people.
Did you obey the order?
Yes, most of them did. I mean, you know, it takes a time to, because they were suspected of us and we were suspect of them. And gradually, but it breaks down kind of thing. And eventually the order came through, you can fraternise. Eventually, I can't remember the time factor on it, but at first it was definitely a non-frat ban.
How did you get on with Germans at that time?
Well, before the frat ban? Or after?
Whilst you were in Lüneburg.
Oh, well, when we used to go, after the frat...
Oh, in Hamburg.
Yeah, after the frat ban was lifted, then you went out to the cafes and all like that, and you'd be surprised. They kind of accepted you, because they'd heard stories, atrocity stories. They didn't know how to... After how the Russians behaved, they didn't know how the Allies would. And, of course, as they realised that we're human, it was more... You were more readily accepted. And I mean, I used to go out and we'd not...